So that is perhaps not the happiest gospel that any of us have ever heard. And there may be a point or two that needs elaboration or interpretation. And I will get to that. I'm eager to talk about the gospel because I think it really reminds us of some very important things. But I want to talk about a couple other things first. And today I'll be kind of stitching back and forth between certain texts of the Old Testament and then see how they're reworked or reinterpreted by the New Testament. And just before we pass on from our gospel hymn, I always want to bring attention to that beautiful line that seems like such a summary of what Jesus did. Love to the loveless shown that they might lovely be. Perfect. First thing I want to talk about is just very briefly this metaphor of the vineyard that we hear about in Isaiah. And the vineyard just crops up over and over again as a metaphor for Israel. And you know, it often shows up unjust tenants or taking possession of it. In this, God's patience seems to be at an end, and you can imagine that the vineyard that is going to be overrun is probably going to be overrun by some foreign army, and the prophetic voice is saying, and that is deserving. But I just want to read a short passage from the New Testament where Jesus picks up again this metaphor of a tree that's not bearing fruit, something of disappointment to the owner. And it gets reworked in a rather more patient way. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came looking for fruit on it and found none. So he said to the gardener, "See here, for 3 years I have come looking for fruit on this fig tree and still find none. Cut it down. Why should it be wasting the soil?" The gardener replied, "Sir, let it alone for one more year until I dig round it and put manure on it. If it bears fruit next year, well and good, but if not, you can cut it down." That sense that this now is the hour of judgment. Jesus says, you know, we are given space and time to become fruitful each in our own way. And again, it is a recasting of sort of the nature of God and our relationship to God. So that's all for Isaiah. Second thing I want to talk about is a passage that actually used to interest me quite a bit more than it. I haven't paid attention to it so much. And it's just that little line from Psalm 82, Psalm 82:6, where the verse is, "Now I say to you, you are gods, and all of you children of the Most High." And the way I used to work with that, and again, you know, issues sort of appear, and then you feel like you've kind of come to some understanding of them. What this passage spoke to in me, and has for many years, has to do with the simplest way of putting the question: is Jesus different from us in kind or in degree? Is he a different kind of being? Or is he simply the same kind of being we are, but radically more open in his heart and in his mind and more faithful in his willingness to surrender to the presence of God and allow himself to be guided by God? I think there are a number of passages, for instance, you know, Jesus telling his disciples, "Are you surprised at the things that I do? Greater things than I, you will do if you're faithful." Always this sense that I'll call it a recessive gene in the New Testament tradition about the real spiritual potential that we already are, that perhaps we have by our very nature a relationship to the presence of God in our hearts and minds, that we too, like Jesus, could open ourselves and truly become much more guided by the presence of God than most of us actually are. Now, this passage, this line from the Psalm, shows up in one of the controversies that we hear about in the Gospel of John. Jesus said, the Father and I are one. The Jews took up stones again to stone him. Again. Not a small word. A little window into the life of Jesus. The Jews took up stones again to stone him. Jesus replied, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these are you going to stone me? The Jews answered, It is not for a good work that we are going to stone you, but for blasphemy. Because you, though only a human being, are making yourself God. Jesus answered, Is it not written in your law? I said you are gods. So Jesus is referring back to the psalm and saying, Wait a minute. We're already intimately connected with God. To say we are one with God is not blasphemy. And of course, there is a way of understanding this language. I'm a God. Near the end of my life in New York, I was stuck in traffic on the Lower East Side, hot, sunny summer day, nobody moving anywhere. And through the traffic came this immense man, naked to the waist, with his arms raised, and he was shouting, I am Zeus. I am Zeus. This is not what Jesus had in mind. This is not the essence of the psalm. There is a way of understanding this that is a great inflation to one's sense of self-importance. I'm a god. I can do whatever I want. I have great power. And of course, this is the exact opposite of what Jesus was meaning and how Jesus was speaking of his oneness with God. And to that, you go to Philippians and dial up that ancient hymn that says, though he was in the form of God, he did not count equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. That's what it means to be one with the Father. Emptied, you know, that's again a metaphor, emptied of the relatively narrow self-concerns that so dominate so many of our lives, and saying, I'm actually going to stay more and more in touch day by day with this interior presence of God that allows me to see it elsewhere. And I'm going to let my life be guided not by my own narrow self-interest, but by where that Spirit leads me and what it shows me that I might do. So it's the exact opposite of this self-aggrandizing inflation. It's the greatest humility we can possibly imagine to say, we are one with the Father, and our lives are guided by that interior presence. On to the gospel. I have to take a breath. Take a breath here. Whenever I come to this passage about families, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is, we don't need Jesus for this. We're able to sort of get 2 against 3 and 3 against 2 pretty easily on our own. The Christian tradition speaks challengingly about families. And so here we are, Jesus saying, do you think I've come to bring peace? Not peace, but division. And I want to connect that with yet another Old Testament passage where Jeremiah is speaking of false prophets. And he says, they have lightly healed my people's wounds. They cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. They have lightly healed my people's wounds. They haven't begun to address the real causes of our disorder, and they haven't even really looked very deeply at the symptoms. They just want to cover things over and try to reassure people that things are all right. And so Jeremiah stands in the middle of that, and he says, they have lightly healed my people's wounds. They cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. And I want to sort of generalize from that a little bit and say that in the biblical vision of human affairs, the peace that we might establish is often a kind of a false peace. It's a peace that is built on convenience, maybe the interests of power, the fear of conflict, a number of things. But the peace really refers to a kind of surface stability which is not supported very well from underneath. And just, I mean, you can look at this, as I say, from a number of different levels. The political level, the international level, when a kind of stability is disrupted, say, for instance, at the end of the Cold War, that sort of held the world somewhat in check by this standoff of two superpowers, when that goes away, all that terrible underlying conflict and hostility in the Balkans erupted. And the same kind of destabilization might be observed in the Middle East, when even terrible, sinister powers, which nonetheless kind of held things in check, when they go away, then nature abhors a vacuum. People come flooding in with my interest and my interest and my interest. The peace that seemed to be is broken apart. Go all the way to the individual level. I may seem peaceful as an individual, but there may come a point in my life when I start to notice that I'm not so peaceful, that I'm anxious, or I'm in conflict about something, or I'm fighting with my family, or any number of things that say to me, kind of who I think I am and who I actually am are not matching up very well. And so that often takes people into therapy, where they go, well, let's see what you're really dealing with. Let's see what you're really dealing with. And the peace that you've tried to maintain and sort of live your ordinary life, that peace goes away. And as they often say in therapy, things get worse before they get better. Things get worse before they get better, because what has been taken away is your normal coping strategies, because they weren't working very well. You want something deeper and better. Families. Am I going to get any argument at all about the sense that within families, I might even be thinking of a Thanksgiving dinner that reunites generations. And it can be happy, and I don't want to take away the possibility of a happy family. I'm all in that. I'm just saying that for most of us, or for many of us, family is an emotional crucible that is very challenging. And the emotional reality of most families is established by a kind of tacit set of agreements about the things you're not going to talk about. We're not going to look at X, or we're not going to talk about Y, and we're going to try to maintain a kind of peace by what we ignore. And so now, I hope I've kind of laid a bit of a groundwork for the kind of division that Jesus brings. He doesn't bring division as a desired end, but as an unavoidable byproduct of telling the truth. Jesus says, you know, you and your human imaginings want to divide the world very neatly into these are good, these are bad, these are sinners, these are righteous. But the real story is always very different from that. And so Jesus metaphorically says, I'm going to come into the room and I'm going to turn the lights on. And I sort of have this image. When the lights come on, everybody has their hand in the cookie jar. So like nobody is exempt. And that's the crucial moment. When the lights come on, the words of Jesus must come to us. Blessed are you if you take no offense at me. Blessed are you if you let the lights come on and you let yourself see and experience the deeper truth of the reality in which you are living every day. But almost every day, you're missing most of it. You're oblivious, or as we would say now, you're unconscious of it. So the lights come on And that's the crisis, because we are so familiar with judgment and shame that our inclination when the lights come on is to run away. And so Jesus says, blessed are you if you take no offense at me. And I want to loop back now to this collect that we read about the Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit giving life to all life, moving all creatures, root of all things, washing them clean, wiping out their mistakes, healing their wounds. You are our true life, luminous, wonderful, awakening the heart from its ancient sleep. Well, that awakening, that healing, that cleansing, that all of that sort of the great benefit, the presence of the Holy Spirit, how do we get to it if the lights don't come on? How do you know that you are truly loved just as you are if you're hiding from who you are all the time? It's like you're blocking out the possibility of actually being loved and accepted, forgiven and renewed. So Jesus says, I have a baptism. And you might say, I have lights to turn on. And oh, I'm afraid of what's going to happen when I do. Especially as he was resolutely going to Jerusalem and going right into the middle of a community that prided itself on its goodness and righteousness. And when the lights come on, those good, righteous people will find that they are complicit just as everyone else is. Not to be condemned, but that with the light of love revealing us and the world to ourselves, we might actually change. To the woman caught in adultery, what did Jesus say? Where are all those who were going to stone you? Where are they? Well, they don't condemn you, and neither do I. But change your life. You're doing stuff that's hurtful, but I'm not going to condemn you. And that was the way Jesus dealt with turning on the lights. What Jesus tells us, and we so rarely believe, is that the truth will set us free. We usually think the truth will destroy us and send us scuttling from the room in humiliation with our heads hanging down. Speak the truth in love. Speak the truth in love organizationally. Do you think a place like St. Andrew's might have hidden little alliances? Has anyone ever gossiped at St. Andrew's? I don't think so. I'm holding it up as a hypothetical possibility that might have happened. You know, and the lights come on. Well, you know, the healthiest family, individual, organization, nation is the one where there is the least discrepancy between what is interior and what is conscious and on the surface. And we're trying to bring those into wholeness and integration. The Holy Spirit, we live and move and have our being within the Holy Spirit of God. But until the lights come on, we are very much inclined to treat that interior presence not as our blessed friend, but as our mortal enemy. Blessed are you if you take no offense at me, if you let yourself be known and loved.